one of those angles is the more closed angle, the smaller number of degrees? Is it the upper one or the lower one? Back to you, Mel.
The only one I could speak about is the lower one. I cannot see the upper one at all. Impossible to see it because it disappears into the tree itself. There's no way to visually see it at this point. So I'm just going to say that I would assume the smaller angle is down on the bottom stick because, like I say, it's not pulled tight. There is a good bulb in the dipole because, first of all, the weight of the coax, you know, in the midpoint, also pulling it slightly, you know, towards the stalk of the tree. Because the coax, that's the way I have to do it, is pull the coax back towards the stalk of the tree and then loop it towards the house. In other words, I have to make everything so it looks, you know, that you, like you say, you go up the block, you would never spot any of this stuff. So the hypotenuse of the triangle basically is bowed somewhat, but I assume from what I can tell you, from what I can see, it's a small angle at the bottom stick over.
KCCQIQ with a quick question.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yes, Mel. What's the length of the 30-meter antenna?
36 feet.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. Could you just say that one more time? Did you say 36 feet?
Oh, 30 meters is 46 feet. It's, the 30-meter band is 10.100, so if you put it into 468, you'll come out with around 46 feet gliding over.
Okay, so very good. So the length of the antenna, the hypotenuse, is 46 feet. It's approximately 15 feet away from the vertical supporting point. And what was the total height of the vertical supporting point?
Yes. Because this is two antennas we're talking about. You were back to the antenna now with 65 feet. The meter is the 46 of the dipole of 30 meters is 46, while I guess 7 megahertz, 40 meters, is 65 feet line over.
Okay, a little bit of interference, but just let's just go over it one more quick time. Okay, so it's 46 feet in the length of the antenna, 15 feet away from the vertical holding point, and the height again was...
Roger. In other words, if you look at the angle it makes with the bowl, and the, I could say it's not a classic straight wire because of the situation, but if you look at it, the way it bows and everything, you know, is the angle on the bottom, if you say the ground was the horizontal reference, the angle that wire makes going up would be around 28 degrees right over.
Very good. Thank you, Bill. So the antenna is more dominantly horizontal.
More commonly vertical, very closer to vertical than horizontal, over.
Okay, so you're measuring the angle on the outside of the antenna against vertical. So from vertical to the wire of the antenna is 28 degrees on the outside.
Right, if you left the wire, in other words, if you had it hanging straight up and down, it would be vertical, and then as you walked out with it gradually, just as you walk out with it, it starts to form an angle with the ground level. It comes out to about, I don't know exactly. I have to, you know, it's hard to paint off because it's in the garden there, but I would assume somewhere like on a 40-meter, the one that's 65 feet long, I go out about, I'd say about 15 feet before I tie it off there to be optimized going over.
Very good, thank you, Mel. So, it's the outside angle that you're keeping through QIQ on the side.
Yes, I've been measuring the outside angle, but using the words of the inside angle, it created a little bit of confusion. One last question on this, Mel. When the wire hung straight down vertical, before you walked it out 15 feet, if at that instant you measured the angle, roughly how many degrees would you measure?
think that's where I got the measurements. I just think, remember you asked me how much of an angle that made with the ground that time, and I think that's when I took a level and stuck them as my reference, you know, because who knows what that ground is, you know. It's a garden. It's up and down. It's a hill, you know, sort of like from the sidewalk to the garden. It goes up like an incline, sort of, and then rounds out and everything. You know, the grass, it's a front lawn. And so I used my reference, and then I stuck a little, cheap little protractor that I had laying here on that level, stuck it on the level. And I looked at, with the group and everything, the bow and the dipole and everything, and it looked like around 28 degrees, approximately, give or take a little bit over.
Okay, we're going to have to drop this one. Let's go to the first mailbag now. Go ahead.
Basic back bottom line is that that a dipole, is that a rule of thumb that basically what I was getting back to? Is it a rule of thumb that a dipole works better at some sloped angle than it would if the dipole was dropped vertically or if the dipole was classically horizontal? In other words, is a sloper a better configuration for a dipole? Let's put it that way, Dick, over.
Your evidence seems to be strongly saying that the sloper works better than any other combination. And there are a significant number of amateurs out there that think that a sloper antenna is the best thing that was invented since baked bread. So there's an awful lot of anecdotal evidence saying that a sloper is the way to go if you got the resources to do it. I don't have anything else to go on but that, Bill. No, go ahead.
Anyhow, if you experiment, you know, you have this facility. Not a very complicated facility, of course. All you need is basically, like I did it with a weight and a pulley and just pull it and just watch your receiver. Basically, it seems like you can find a point where the dipole works better. And it's not much weight from the vertical, I should say, you know, only a if the vertical drops vertical and then you walk it out, you're not walking it out a heck of a lot of distance considering the length of the dipole to begin with, Dick, over.
Yep, I'm getting that picture. Do you have an email you think we should be answering, Mel?
Yeah, like I say, it's an interesting subject to talk about this indefinitely. And like you say, a lot of people have said slopers are one of the better antenna systems that you can put up that really are simple, very simple, and no doubt very cheap to put up. All right, let me see if I can find something here. Hold on.
In the meantime, N2RSO with a comment on vertical.
Go ahead, N2RSO.
First, let me ask, is my audio better this week than last week?
Sounds awful good right now, Frank.
Okay, I switched mics. My comment is on what I believe to be an easy way to connect radio counterpoise to a vertical antenna. The antenna that comes to mind immediately is the classic flagpole antenna, consisting of sections of aluminum tubing going up 20 to 25 feet. I recently upgraded my electrical service from 100 amps to 200 amps, and when I stripped out the old panel, I realized I had a couple of bus bars in there. Now, if you can picture one of these bus bars with approximately 14 poles and 14 screws, what's an easy way to connect radio? Just one piece of wire in each hole and tighten the screws, and then mount this thing at the base of the antenna and connect it to the ground shield of your PL-259. What do you think of my idea, Dick?
Well, mechanically and electrically, it's a beauty. And if you're willing to lay down a whole lot of ground plane radials, because you're building a quarter wave radiator type ground plane, then it can be a very effective antenna. If you have the resources to make the radiator a half wave instead of quarter wave, you do get a lot more performance. It's a little bit more difficult than the expansion problem at the base of the antenna, but you get a lot more performance, and you have the choice, if you want, to use a much smaller number of ground plane radials. That's one of the things that we've been deriving about vertical antennas. And that also got us into slopers, so I think you see where we're going with that one. Sounds to me like you're thinking pretty strongly of building a quarter wave type, not a half wave type. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, that's pretty much the case, Dick. I have a flagpole with aluminum sections going up at 22 to 25 feet, and I sort of connecting it, well, first insulating it from the base, and then connecting it to an FGC or ICOM, a tuna, and or coupler, rather, as they could call. And it bothered me wondering how I could attach the radials, and as I said, when I stripped the paddle, a light bulb went off and said, hey, this is the way to do it. By the way, you don't have to destroy your panel, your electrical panel at home in order to get these. These little bus bars are available at Home Depot and probably Lowe's for less than a $10 bill. And it sure beats that plate that DX Engineering is selling for anywhere from $50 up to $125, depending on all the extras you get from it. So for less than a $10 bill and whatever wire you have, I think this is the way to go. Okay, back to you, Dick, and to our assistant.
That's good. Sounds like a nice bargain. What band do you intend to use the ground plane antenna on, Frank?
Sorry, Dick, I got called away for a second. I missed that.
Your ground plane vertical, what band do you intend to use it on?
Well, I'm hoping that it's 10 meters comes back soon, and I think I should be able to do at least 10 to 20, especially at the 40 maybe, depending on the length of my radio.
Understand. Okay. Good luck with that project, and let us know how it goes. Back to you, Mel.
K2KY. Well, that's why with my radio situation outside, all fine, you know, when you make mechanical connections, but you got to do something to prevent Mother Nature from corroding and do, you know, making it so that the contact of the wires eventually are not going to make a good grounding to the plate. So, you know, contact to the plate. So what I did, I used a copper plate. Basically, I just had a nice sheet of copper and just dotted the numbers using, well, of course, all my radio number 22 wire. I just dotted them one after another really quickly down to that copper plate stick over.
Sounds like a good way to go. And so we better hurry and do a couple of the emails now, or they're going to get angry at us.
All right, here's one interesting. I'm going to change the subject a little bit for, which is good once in a while. I'm an old-timer, but not an old-timer ham. However, I do enjoy CW. Ah, man after my own heart. Okay. Now, the only problem is I am having trouble with my hearing, and I just can't seem to tune in the way I'd like to hear the CW tone. A friend of mine said that there are such things as active filters. Can you say some words about active filters, and would this possibly help me? And I can picture what he's talking about, cascade-type filters that you can put between your audio product detector or audio circuits, using an AF amplifier or whatever, you know, I'll let you say some words about active filters first so I can arrange my thoughts to take over.
Yeah, they're especially made hearing aids for people who are losing a portion of the spectrum where it's hard for them to interpret speech, and they have a particularly tough time in the cocktail party effect. In other words, they're in a room full of people, everybody's jabbering away, and they have quite a bit of trouble picking out one human from all the others. And if you don't have the full spectrum and the full digital signal processor working, so to speak, within your ears, between your ears, then that becomes difficult. These specialized hearing aids, I think they are a carefully tailored bandpass filter. Now, in the case of the kind of active filter you're talking about, it is a kind of a audio equivalent of a Q multiplier. You can adjust one of these. Salen key is the name of a kind of a filter. You take an operational amplifier, put the right kind of R's and C's around it, and as you tune the R's and C's, you can decide what frequency it's going to emphasize, and it's going to reject all others. So it can become a bandpass filter where you can adjust the bandwidth and you can adjust the center frequency. And if your hearing happens to work well at, I'm going to pick a number, 700 hertz, you can adjust one of these active filters so that primarily nothing but 700 hertz plus or minus 20 hertz comes through and everything else is rejected. And because it's rejecting all the other noise that's on the band and all the other tones, for a person who has a limited frequency spectrum, once you find the sweet spot in your hearing, I think that can help a lot. So do you believe that that's what we're discussing here, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, I think we're just basically talking about also have been, you know, experimenting over the years with filters. We've gone through quite a bit of discussions on filters. Active filters, basically, that's what you had said, your friend mentioned, they fall into a number of categories, I guess we could say that. There's the low-pass filter, there's the high-pass filter, these are all audio filters, there's a fan-pass filter, and then there's a fan-reject type filter. Now, the one that you're talking about, in case of, you know, listening to CW, what is usually what, in fact, I remember, I think Eastkit had one on the market, was called a, basically, if I remember correctly, a two-pole active CW filter that was in the audio chain. And do you recall that filter, Dick? I think it was like a 750-cycle filter, am I correct? Do you know anything? Well, maybe you can. In fact, I think the circuit was published, you know, in a number of magazines years ago, like QSP and CU and all those. It's to publish those simple circuits, which, like you say, was made with like a up amplifier, what the heck else they use, like a couple of transistors, I think they used to use. Basically, I think, like you say, it was up amplifier type of device. Am I correct, over?
I don't remember the Eastkit product, but I do know that if you go to the Google on the World Wide Web and you Google the word active filter, active bandpass filter, active band reject filter, active low pass, high pass, but active bandpass, I think it's the one we're probably talking about, guarantee you'll get a whole lot of hits. And some of them have got some nice schematic diagrams, usually nowadays with operational amplifiers. And some of these operational amplifiers are in the bubble pack at Radio Shack for considerably less than a dollar per unit. And they've got a lot of gain inside. Once you use them correctly, they use pretty good performance. They create pretty good performance. An active low, active bandpass filter with narrow band response, which is what I think you need to get best CW reception in a crowded band with other kinds of noise, is a little bit like having an extremely active audio equalizer network where it's got a whole bunch of these slide switches that emphasize the low end, the medium end, the high end of the band, and all the other places in between. and you take one of those light switches, like the one near 700 Hertz, push it to the ceiling, and push all the other equalizer light switches all the way down to the ground. So you're just emphasizing that one tone and a few of the frequencies around that tone and rejecting everything else. That would be a somewhat narrow band. Let me drop. Bandpass filter, which you can easily build with op-amp. And you can install that within the audio system of your ham rig. Or the op-amps could easily drive a set of earphones, because they don't need very much power. Or the output of the op-amp, because most op-amps don't have a whole lot of power to them. They got a lot of gain, but not a whole lot of output power. You could then put that into an audio driver circuit that's also a bubble pack at the Radio Shack, and that in turn drives the loudspeaker or a whole set of earphones if that's what you want to do. And in the old days, Radio Shack used to have a completely separate audio amplifier you could buy that ran on either flashlight batteries or a 9-volt battery or whatever, or a 12-volt power supply. There's lots of ways of doing it. But in my opinion, once you find the sweet spot in your hearing, where your hearing is active, and here you and I are speculating, it might be 700 Hertz with this guy, and it might be 300 Hertz with another guy, and it might be 1 kilohertz with a third guy. Wherever you find that sweet spot in your particular hearing, and by building one of these variable tunable bandpass filters, or using an equalizer network, and just to push those light switches up and down, you'll eventually find your sweet spot. And if you emphasize that and reject everything else, I think you're going to get the best possible Morse code reception. The only other thing to be concerned about a little bit is the ringing of the filter. There are various ways of designing the filter with high Q and low Q, critically damped, or a filter that is very undamped. The thing you want to try to avoid is a filter that rings. You don't want it to act like a bell when you hit it once and you hear a tone for a long period of time, even nobody's hitting the bell. You don't want to have a situation where somebody gives you a dip and the ringing of your filter stretches it into a dot. You want a filter that stops making sound as soon as the guy stops sending the code. So you've got to be a little bit careful with the ringing characteristics, damping factor they call it, or a Q of the filter. But choose the right center frequency, choose the right bandwidth, choose the right damping factor, and I think you're going to get the best you can out of your hearing system. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY, do you want to comment?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, something that I have done here is most of the CW work that I've done, I haven't used anything external, but I guess when the first confusing thing for me, it might be the same thing that you might be experiencing, is that initially when I was trying to tune onto a frequency of the station, depending on how I'm tuning the frequency, was I really on frequency with the individual, or was I just really adjusting the frequency to see if I was getting the right pitch that I was looking for? So what I did was I went back to a station where I knew the exact frequency, like 71AW, when they were transmitting CW. I adjusted my digital PS940 exactly to that frequency. Then what I used was the 500 Hertz CW filter to make sure all the CW was all filtered and all the QRM was out of the background. And then I used the variable pitch control, the PVC control, in the front of the radio, so I could find the most comfortable pitch for my reception. And then usually it would work pretty well. But I think initially it's hard first to know, you know, once you have the pitch set to where it's comfortable, then you can tune the frequency when you're listening to the live station that you're actually on frequency with them and you recognize the pitch that you're comfortable with. KTQ2IQ.
I have an alternative to filter.
Yeah, go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, that issue was a problem for me as well, because in my youth I like to listen to hard music and very loud music. I built myself a phase lock loop with an SDE or an NE666 that actually locks into the audio. And when the lock is done, the output indicates lock, and that will trigger a local oscillator, and this will the CW, and this way, in this way the CW is actually regenerated there locally without any external noise,
It's based on the fact that CW is a coherent signal, while the noise is random. So it allows the PLLs actually to lock under the noise. So you might be surprised what you're going to hear with that. And to an end, back to Dick.
That sounds like a very nice arrangement, Alex. What we're really talking about here is that many rigs, many modern rigs, have an RIT control, receiver incremental tuning, RIT, where you can adjust what tone you're listening to without moving the receiver. And just to show you an exaggerated problem that happens, the guys on 10 gigahertz quite often end up walking themselves up the band or down the band. In other words, a guy hears Morse code, he adjusts to a nice high pitch that he likes hearing, and therefore he happens to be transmitting a couple of kilohertz higher in frequency than the guy he's listening to. Then when he turns it back to the other guy, the guy says, gee, the pitch is not right. He readjusts his main frequency dial on his receiver and moves up a little bit higher. And each time they go back and forth to each other, they're slowly walking up the band. That happens when you use the main tuning dial on your receiver. You really should be using the RIT knob instead. Both guys should be using the RIT knob. That way you don't end up walking up the band. You're just adjusting the pitch that your receiver gives you as opposed to really moving your transmit frequency. Many rigs have an automatic offset, and no two rigs have the same amount of offset is one of the problems. When in doubt, you really should be using a second transceiver, listening on the band, and so that you hear a guy out of both receivers, you then transmit with yours, and with the second receiver, by listening to it, you find out whether or not you're transmitting on his frequency, above his frequency, or below his frequency. Because each manufacturer adjusts for what they think is the proper tone, 500 hertz, 600 hertz, 800 hertz, 1 kc, 1200 hertz, for Morse code reception. The amount of offset they build into the rig is not the same. And so you've got to do a couple of experiments with your friends or with a second receiver to find out what you've got to do with the knob on your rig to make sure you're transmitting on the same frequency that the guy you're listening to. You got to get used to the idiosyncrasies in this area of your particular rig. And some Morse code stations, some DX stations, may not respond unless you're right on their frequency. Well, if it's a really good DX station, the guy says, I don't want everybody piling on my frequency. I'm listening 10 kc up the band. And you've got to know a lot more about your rig to know how to make sure you're transmitting where he's listening, exactly 10 kc up the band. So there's more to this than first meets the eye. What else is
new? Repeater, timeout.
What else is new? Back to you, Mel. K2KUI, K2LAW.
Precisely, that's why I use the Collins S line, which is a separate receiver and a separate transmitter. You can go transceive on it, but I run split on it. And the reason for that is, on the receiver, I have a gadget that actually matches the tone. In other words, I put on this tone, and I move the receiver dial, the VFO and the dial on the receiver now, until the tone actually matches. You can hear it beat out to the exact tone. I now then zero beat that with the transmit of VFO. That puts me precisely on the exact frequency of the CW station. And that way, if he says now, like you say, the DX station is listening up so many kilohertz, I can know that is my precise point. So if I got to go five from that, it's very easy for me to watch the dial. You know, and move the dial up five and re-zero beat it that way, Dick. Just move the VFO dial, which is fairly accurate, up from that point. But that always puts me on precise spots. A lot of them running very narrow filters. So that's basically the way I do it. And let me let it drop. more about the, you know, active potency. I remember Heathkit had that out back when Heathkit was around. And what did they have? They had what they call a variable Q active band filter. That had actually a variable center frequency that you added, of course, again, in those days it was separate, mostly all separate receivers that transmitted. Very few people were running transceivers in those days, you know, a transceiver. So they had that gadget called the variable Q active bandpass filter. It had a variable sensor frequency on it. I was going to say a couple of words about that. Do you want to make any comments before I say a few words about this gadget? Over.
Yep. Well, first of all, with your Collins equipment, you've learned all the idiosyncrasies of your equipment, and you've learned how to get around them. Alex solved the problem with an automatic phase lock loop. That once his phase lock loop locks into a particular Morse code frequency, his rig is automatically set on the right frequency. And now, I think there are modern-day rigs you can buy which have digital signal processing built in, not only for the IF, but also for the audio, where you've not only got the center frequency IF shift tuning, but you can also twist knobs on the front panel which adjust the upper roll-off frequency and the lower roll-off frequency of the audio system. So by twisting the knobs on the front panel of a modern-day rig, you have many of these characteristics of the narrow bandpass audio filter. I keep forgetting the name of the commercial product that's made to do all that. So, unless you're careful, you got to choose a filter of the right bandwidth and the right center frequency that helps you, and you got to worry about not making the bandwidth too narrow where the ringing characteristics become excessive. Common sense would lead you to believe that a 700 Hz is my favorite frequency. My hearing works the best there, and I'm doing Morse code reception. You would be tempted to make a 700 Hz center frequency audio filter that is only 1 Hz wide. Well, in theory, with only 1 Hz of bandwidth in that filter, you couldn't get dots and dashes through there any faster than 1 dot per second, so to speak. That would be very slow Morse code. And if you try to go any faster than that, the ringing of the filter, if you transmit a dot into that filter, it would still give you a 700 Hz tone for the next couple of seconds as it slowly decays. So you got to be careful not to make it too narrow. And by way of these DSP-type modern rigs, you can tailor the passband to fit your particular situation, for your particular Morse code speed, your amount of desirable ring, your amount of bandwidth, your upper lower cutoff frequencies. It's the equivalent of having a very active high gain equalizer network in the audio system. Back to you, Mel.
This is K2KDY. You brought up a very good point that all these active filters that like Pete put out and all, they had a very limited dynamic range so that the you couldn't vary them a heck of a lot without, you know, having a situation where many cases what would happen. Sometimes a out-of-band input signal would maybe overload this active device and cause a distortion of the desired signal. So, like I say, it's there was a number of these circuits you could try. There's no reason you can't experiment with. They're very simple circuits, basically, based on using op amplifiers and maybe a couple of transistors. You got to understand the constraints of the active filter, really. That's basically the bottom word. The bottom line on this is on the line. This has a bit of a constraint using active filters. Take over.
Now, like everything else, if a little bit is good, people think, well, more must be better. And that's not always true. If you're taking medication, more may not be better. If you're narrowing the passband, you can take it too far, where now you slow things down. One of Shannon's laws of communication theory says that Unless you use the more exotic techniques that are being used these days, block encoding techniques, you can't get information through a filter much faster than the bandwidth of the filter. I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit. In other words, if you build an audio filter at 700 Hz center frequency that is only 10 Hz wide, in theory, in simplified theory, you can't get more than 10 bits of information per second through that filter. And even then, that's going to be at a bit of a compromise. So you got to be careful not to take it too far. There are people who have bought these audio bandpass filters and had all kinds of knobs on them where they could adjust them very narrow. And when they adjusted it very narrow, they heard this ringing characteristic. That's what it sounds like to a Morse code receiving person. And they thought that something was defective with the circuit. And they tried complaining back to the manufacturer. And what they didn't realize is they're running into some very basic laws of physics here. And Shannon, in his writings on the subject of communication theory, made that pretty clear. Back to you, Mel. Maybe we should go to the next one, K2RIW.
This is K2KDY. Eric, like I say, quite a large subject on filters. So, depth of wall is... Google it, and you'll be able to get a world of information on it if you want to pursue active filters. Nothing wrong with experimenting. You just may find what you need. All right, let's see. What do we got? Oh, all right, let's see about antennas again. what is MANFI? Here we are. What is MANFI? Optimum elevation angle on different bands. Well, this is another story. I think we sort of touched upon this last week. In fact, I even answered this then. You'll find that different parts of the country have a different elevation angle to, like, say, to Europe. In other words, right, if I was here, getting on, say, 10 meters, and my elevation angle to Europe would be different here in the Northeast, would be different to, say, the Midwest or West Coast. How do you explain? Okay, maybe I'll let you say a few words on optimum elevation angle. Over.
Yeah, we're running into a little bit of a problem of like a mirror, where a mirror operates where angle of incidence equals angle of reflection. You look at a mirror at a grazing angle, the signal goes in at a grazing angle, comes out at a grazing angle. If you stand directly in front of the mirror, the signal comes in at a right angle, and comes back out at a right angle. The IR sphere is a kind of a mirror. It acts that way. And so between you and your buddy in London, I'm not sure the particular state of the ionosphere today would be best for one hop or two hops, one bounce of the ionosphere or two bounce between here and London. But in order to accomplish that one or two bounces, there is an ideal angle good for this hour of this day, this state of the ionosphere, this state of the sunspot cycle, which gives you the best reception to your buddy in London. And if then you want to talk to your buddy in Moscow, a different angle would be optimum. Your next question is, once you know the optimum angle for the state of the ionosphere today, during the time you want to make the QSO, how do you accomplish that angle? Well, one approach would be to make sure that your antenna has a broad enough vertical beamwidth that it encompasses all of those angles. That's one approach. But the more sophisticated approach would be to realize that the angle of the signal coming off your antenna, if it's a horizontally polarized antenna, that angle is predetermined by the number of wavelengths your antenna is above the ground. As far as the antenna is concerned, the ground is another mirror. There's a real antenna above the ground, a mirror image of one below the ground. Because of the way ground reflection acts with 180-degree phase reversal, those two antennas, the real and the image, are 180 degrees out of phase. That means, in general, you always have a null on the horizon, and some number of degrees above the horizon is where they come back in phase with each other, because there's a longer path to the image antenna than to the real antenna. So the two signals, the image and the real signal, image signal is of course due to ground bounce, but diagrammatically you can make a simplified diagram and make believe you just have two emitting antennas, one above the ground and one below the ground. And you come out with the same answer, and it's easier to see what's going on. So when you choose the elevation of your antenna above the ground, you are uniquely choosing the elevation angles, and there's usually more than one of them, as long as you've got a number of wavelengths above the ground, where your signal peak, what elevation angle. If this is the best of all worlds, you've either got, let me drop this, you've either got a way of raising or lowering your antenna, depending on what angle you want to calculate you want to transmit today, knowing the state of the ionosphere, or conversely, you've got a number of antennas in your background because they're simple pieces of wire. You've got some high ones, medium ones, and low ones, and choose the right one for that particular guy you want to talk to, for that particular range. Wire is fairly inexpensive. Coax cable ain't that expensive. Hang a bunch of antennas at different altitudes, different angles, with a big rotary switch in the shack, or a bunch of BNC connectors. You can easily connect and disconnect them and find out which one works the best when you're listening to your buddy in London. The hard thing a lot of guys don't know is an amazing number of guys have written articles saying, I'm taking my three-element Yagi, and I'm tilting it 30 degrees above the horizon to favor that particular elevation angle. They think they're favoring that elevation angle by tilting the Yagi itself. Good common sense. 90% wrong. It turns out the ground reflection is so dominant on choosing your elevation angle that you tilting the Yagi itself, you're almost wasting your time. The Yagi itself has got a fairly broad vertical beamlet to it. The real vertical angle that you transmit is determined by the number of wavelengths your antenna is off the ground. Once you realize it's the number of wavelengths, you'll suddenly realize that if you've got a multi-band antenna that's 40 feet above the ground, it'll have one vertical elevation angle for 40 meters, a lower one for 20 meters, an even lower one for 15 meters when it comes to that first vertical lobe. By the time you get up to 15 meters, you probably have one vertical lobe down low and another one up high. They start getting more lobes as you get more wavelengths above the ground. Again, there's a lot of advantage in having either a way of raising and lowering the antenna with pulleys or whatever, or having multiple antennas and a way of switching between them. The antennas tend not to be that expensive. That's where you get a lot of bang for the dollar by putting up more antennas. K2KEY, K2LIW. K2KEY,
you're 100% right. I've gotten up through that experience, as I've said many times, that I have a loop outside, which is approximately 45 feet above the ground. I have a dipole that's 65 feet up by 80 meters. I have the vertical, and I have the antenna, the receiving antenna in the shack. And as I said many times, it no one fits all. And the reason for that is, if I take the loop outside, it works great. If I'm going, for instance, a radius, like I talk to my friends, a few hundred miles radius up north into Massachusetts, down south around Virginia or Maryland, westward or so towards Pennsylvania, worked great for that because if you looked at, most likely you look at the response, the elevation pattern of those antennas, you will find that most likely the lower antenna might loop has more response at high elevation angles, while the other antennas at higher most likely has a better elevation for the lower angle. So no doubt the higher antenna is with a lower angle, no doubt it may be giving me a higher peak gain for the lower angle. I think that's the best way to explain it, Dick. Depends on what you're really going to do with the antenna, whether you're looking for local rag chewing or looking to work DX on that particular band, over.
Yeah, I'm fairly sure that there are DX towns that have set up websites that you can go to where they keep track at every hour what is the state of the ionosphere, what is the prediction, therefore how many miles to the east beyond the gray zone, at what hour of the day, what band at what hour of the day at what angle of elevation angle is going to give you the best propagation to whatever country or whatever part of the country you want to talk to. Once you know that, there is a formula that's in the ARL antenna book that will allow you to calculate how many wavelengths above the ground will my antenna give me that calculated elevation angle that I desire, that the predictors, their website, tell me is going to give me the best performance today. So you can maximize your degree of success to continue to hold that schedule with your buddy in London at the 2 in the afternoon on every Tuesday if that's what you want to do. This is all 90% deterministic. It's 90% predictable. The mathematics and the science is there. So you can find, I'm pretty sure there is a propagation section of a number of the ham radio magazines and a number of websites that will tell you what part of the country is best to use what band, what part of the day, and what elevation angle. And you can get that one by choosing the right altitude above the ground and plugging it into a formula. And eventually when you draw the geometry of this, the formula will eventually make some sense and you'll see why it works. But the altitude of your antenna is a much stronger determinant of your elevation angle than where you tilt your antenna. Opposite of common sense. Back to you, Mel. Go ahead, Glenn.
Combine the connection, but I won't come in.
Wait a minute, hold it.
Yeah, Alex has got it. Go ahead, Alex.
Here, everybody's doubling. Okay. First, Glenn. Just go ahead, Glenn, by yourself first.
Yeah, Dick, I have a quick question for you about log periodic. I forget where I read it, but I'm not sure if the information was correct or not, but they had mentioned that the effect of the elevation of the antenna log periodic is less sensitive to end of radiation over wide band as opposed to Yagi's and other antennas. Is there any truth to that? Or?
I doubt it highly. That may be another one of these rumors that sort of became fact because a whole lot of hams keep telling each other, but it may not be accurate. The good news about a log periodic is it's got a lot of bandwidth. The bad news is a log periodic, unless you use one of the more exotic designs that's physically very large, they don't have a huge amount of gain. For the amount of aluminum you put up there, on one band at a time, you get a lot more gain out of a single band Yagi than you can out of a log. The way the log periodic works is that you feed the nose of the thing. The signal goes down that crisscross twin lead that's the feed line between all the elements. And when it sees a set of elements that are near the resonant frequency, the signal starts flowing down those elements. So you have 2, 3, maybe 4 elements that are active at a time, no more. So rarely do they exceed 7 or 8 dB of gain. So because they're a fairly low gain antenna with a fairly broad beamwidth, for someone to say that they're going to have less effect of altitude seems opposite of common sense compared to a single band Yagi. If I had an extremely long single band high gain Yagi, now it's got a very narrow beamwidth, and as you can see in three-dimensional space on the drop, it would be this more narrow cucumber in space. When I've got a very long Yagi, now I can de-emphasize the ground reflection a little bit. I can literally tilt that antenna high enough above the horizon, and because its beamwidth is so narrow, there is now very little ground reflection. And in that particular case, the altitude above the ground is not as important. But it takes a lot of elements of a very long Yagi to get into that ballpark where none of the main lobe of the Yagi, when it's tilted up in elevation, none of it is striking the ground. Almost every other real antenna you and I touch, Glenn, a lot of that signal is touching the ground. There is ground reflection, and therefore altitude above the ground in wavelength determines elevation angle, not where you aim the antenna. And because a log only has a couple of elements active at a time, it's the equivalent of a short Yagi. So I've got a lot of skepticism about that rumor. I think it's only a rumor. Back to you, Glenn.
3-4-1.
Joe recognized, but Glenn first. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, that's the way I would look at it. Although it is interesting, a couple of suns that use log periodically seem to, at 1/6 height, have very good performance in all bands, but I don't know if that's any kind of a comparison. But going a little bit further on a couple of words that you had mentioned, is there a minimum gain that you would think the oral round selection becomes less critical in the forward direction?
You can sort of find this one out geometrically yourself. A rough rule of thumb is that if they take more than a 2 or 3 element Yagi, 4 elements and more for sure, the horizontal beam width and the vertical beam width of the antenna in free space become more and more similar. And now you can use that as a product. If I take the horizontal beam width and the vertical beam width and multiply them together, they will come out roughly 30,000. Let me think about that. Let me do it backwards. If I take the number 30,000 square degrees, and I take the gain of the antenna, not in decibels, I've anti-logged the gain of the antenna from decibels to a real number, and I divide it into 30,000. That is the product of the horizontal and vertical beam width. Let me give you an example. Assume I had an antenna with 10 decibels of gain. I chose 10 dB because I know very quickly the anti-log of that happens to also be 10. I now take 10 and divide it into 30,000. I get 3,000. That means my horizontal beam width multiplied by my vertical beam width is 3,000. I can take the square root of 3,000, and maybe the number happens to be 65 degrees. That is my approximate horizontal and vertical beam width. I'm going to get my actual calculator. So you can, knowing the gain of your antenna, you can estimate its beam width, or the manufacturer has told you its beam width. If you're able to tilt the antenna in elevation such that the majority of the main lobe, I'm going to call it 5 or 6 dB down, no longer touches the ground, now the elevation of the antenna above the ground becomes almost unimportant. There's always a little bit of side lobes and whatever touching the ground. But as long as the great big wide main lobe has been made narrow enough that you can now make it miss the ground, now you are controlling the elevation angle, not the altitude, controlling it with ground reflection. I think you see the principle, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's clear. I'm not sure how easy it is to calculate yet, but I'm going to give it a try. Thanks for expecting KC2QIQ.
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting rules of thumb. 30,000 divided by gain equals the product of horizontal and vertical beam width. Another rule of thumb is that in the case of a horn antenna, 70 degrees divided by the number of wavelengths of width of the mouth of the horn tells you the beam width of the horn. If I had a horn that was 4 wavelengths wide, and I divide 4 into 70, 35 is 2, half of 35, I guess is 17 and a half. I'd have a 17 and a half degree beam width coming out of that horn. Rough rule of thumb. 70 degrees divided by the number of wavelengths is the beam width coming out of the horn. And by the way, you measure beam width horizontal, that tells you horizontal beam width. You measure number of wavelengths vertical, that tells you the vertical beam width when you divide it into 70 degrees. Interesting rules of thumb. Joe, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, you got it.
Yeah, I've been listening to your conversation about the apparent angle of the antenna, horizontally polarized antenna. My question in this would be, does the type of ground you're above have a major or minor impact versus the wavelengths you are above the ground?
Good question, Joe, and I'm glad you asked it. I think it's a major one. We've heard a number of people say that beverage antennas and a lot of antennas, when they're on these de-expeditions and they're near water, that horizontally polarized antennas at a de-expedition give very poor performance. And so the high reflectivity of the water, makes the lobes in space due to ground reflection become very significant. So highly conductive ground is going to give you very distinct lobes of your vertical elevation angle radiated signal in space. Conversely, you allow me to locate my HF antenna in the middle of the Mojave Desert, where the soil is very dry sand with very low conductivity. Because the sand is so low in conductivity, the amount of reflection off that sand is also a hell of a lot lower. The net result is that when you now plot the elevation pattern for that antenna, the peaks are nowhere near as high, the valleys are nowhere near as low in the elevation pattern, because there's very little ground reflection. It's the ground reflection that gives you those peaks and valleys. You choose ground that's low enough in conductivity, that antenna almost thinks it's in free space. There ain't no ground there. So when it comes to elevation angle, horizontally polarized antennas, ground conductivity, I think, makes a pretty big deal. Back to you, Joe.
So, thusly, there wouldn't really be any easy way to determine it unless you could sort of determine what your ground conductivity was. And how many wavelengths would you say is the optimum per band? Say, like, take 10 meters, for example. How many wavelengths would you have to have that antenna above the ground to give the optimum angle?
Okay, you've asked a question with a double ambiguity. First, from the propagation report of what is the state of the ionosphere and how many miles away is the guy you want to talk to, there is a predictable elevation angle you desire. Now, if it's a horizontally polarized antenna above moderately conducting ground, you plug it into that formula that's got a sine function in it. I can't remember the formula, but it's in the ARO antenna book. You plug your formula of altitude in wavelength into that, you plug your number of altitudes in wavelength into that formula, it'll tell you what the elevation angle will be because of altitude. And if you can make your elevation angle to your altitude equal the optimum elevation angle that is required for today's propagation state, and that guy you want to talk to in this hour of the day, you bring that all together, and you just guaranteed by 95% probability you're going to talk to the ideal elevation angle. That's almost like saying, well, what is the ideal woman? Is she a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead? There's a lot of variables involved in both cases. I think you see what I'm saying here, Joe. Go ahead.
Yes, you're right. I should have qualified that question. I should have given you, said something like, say, you desire an angle of 30 degrees.
Okay. I'm going to re-derive this now. 30 degrees up, and you're getting an extra half wavelength because of ground reflection. You get 180 degrees because of ground reflection, and I want the path to the image antenna at an infinite distance to be exactly 180 degrees longer than the real antenna. I'm going to work out the mathematics of that, or else I'm going to go get my ARO antenna book. While Mel gives us the next email, I'm going to be working out the mathematics of that one for you, Joe. Mel, you got it. K2YIW.
I can say a few words about this, Joe. There's a guy that operates HF. He has a tower that the top antennas are about 100, close to 200 feet high. He's got on 20 meters, he's got one of the stepper systems. Well, he's got the stepper antenna system, basically. He's capable of running 6 over 6 over 6, or individual antennas, or putting them all together. And he, many times, will find, again, depending on where the station is talking to, he may go to the lower antenna, which is approximately about a half wavelength above ground on 20 meters. And you say, gee, boy, I bet you that if you switch to one of the upper-level antennas, I guarantee you it would be a much better signal from A to B at this particular point, but not necessarily. So many times, again, the real serious super DXs will have antennas at different heights for that band and be able to, you know, switch it to the appropriate antenna for that particular communication between those two points. Let me see if Dick is back before. I was going to say some words about logs and periodics also that I was really curious about, but I think I know the answer. But all right, let's first, Dick, are you back? Over.
Yes, I am. First of all, Joe, 30 degrees of elevation angle is, in my opinion, extremely high. That's a very short-range propagation for one hop. You're going to talk to a guy only a few hundred miles away, so 30 degrees is very high. But that turns out to be half wavelength above the ground. The sine of 30 degrees is 0.5. I want that that extra length of the right triangle to be half as long as the hypotenuse. The hypotenuse is one wavelength long in that case. Since the hypotenuse is made of the length of the hypotenuse is the distance above ground real and distance below ground to image, and the two add together to be one wavelength, the answer is half wavelength above the ground. So half wavelength above the ground, if I didn't make a math error, your peak elevation angle for a horizontally polarized antenna is 30 degrees up above the horizon. And I think it's a rather rare case that you desire 30 degrees. I think if you're a real DX hound, you'd much rather have something like 10 degrees, in my opinion. But that's a function of the state of the ionosphere. For a quick break, Joe, does that make a little bit of sense to you? W2RYY, K2RYW?
Yes, it does. I understand the higher the angle, the shorter you're going to go. I just use 30 just as an odd number, or just a number to throw at you. There was nothing specific meant by it.
Okay. And eventually, Burl, I did this with a simple geometric diagram. I'll eventually re-derive a formula, but I guarantee that formula is in the ARL antenna book. Mel, you've got it. And we've only got 5 minutes left.
Hey, so let me say a few words. Let's finish up with log periodics, because that's basically how we got to this point. Is it true, because I think you have more experience with log periodics, I've had very little experience to say directly with them other than what I've read, but I remember a couple of comments from people that were really involved with log periodics, and is it true that the gain varies widely across the spectrum of the log periodic coverage? Is that a correct factor, that they are not constant in gain over their supposedly designed spectrum? Is that true, Dick? Over.
Definitely not true for a conventional log. A conventional log has a fixed ratio between all of the elements, a fixed taper rate, you could call it, and as such, the number of elements that are active on each frequency within the range that the log is designed for, the number of active elements, is almost the same. Yes, when you're on the high end of the band, you're using the short element, and when you're on the low end of the band, you're using the long element, but you're lighting up very close to the same number of elements. The effective capture area goes up with wavelength, or goes down with frequency. I've got to go backwards. Lower frequency, larger capture area, same verse, because you're using the bigger element. If I was lighting up nothing but one single element, a dipole, and a dipole has an effective area of 0.13 lambda squared, it stands to reason that a longer dipole, when resonated, has got more area. An 80-meter dipole has got four times more area than a 40-meter dipole, 0.13 lambda squared. Twice the frequency, 4-to-1 ratio area. So a log periodic does it. The effective area goes up as you go down in frequency, as you're lighting up the bigger elements, but the gain, the beamless, stays very close to the same. It wiggles around a little bit. The Biswell wiggles around a little bit. The gain wiggles around a little bit. But with a good design log, the gain is almost flat. The beamless is almost flat. The Biswell is reasonably flat on a good design. So people may have confused effective capture area and gain, and the variable that's going on there simultaneously is wavelength, and it creates confusion. So the gain is somewhat flat on a good design, in my opinion. Back to you, Mel.
I'm ahead of a comment here. Alex,
let's see what Alex has to say. He's probably worked with some. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, this is referred to the illumination area that I called. I'm not sure exactly right now, but my feeling is from the previous work that the illumination area does not increase or decrease with the size of the element as it is related to the wavelength. So if you have a very small antenna but a very high frequency, you might have the same illumination factor, in other words, capture that many microvolts like a very large antenna on a very long wavelength. So the illumination area, or the capture area, if you want to call it this way, is actually depending on the wavelength that you're working at.
I think you and I are saying the same thing from different point of view. You are saying the wavelength, the capture area, is related to the wavelength, where I think you said on the very last sentence, there I agree. And you're lighting up more than one element, three or four elements. That's why it's got a front-to-back ratio. It's got a Yagi-like phenomena to it. But the number of elements you light up on each frequency within its range is about the same. When you go to the higher frequency, you're lighting up the smaller elements up front. You're lighting up a smaller area. The elements are smaller. If it was nothing but a dipole, each dipole is an effective area at resonance, 0.13 lambda squared. So the effective area is going up and down as the frequency goes down and up. But the beamwidth stays very much the same. Therefore, I'm saying the gain stays very much the same. Now, people can confuse area going up and down, and gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared. The area going up and down is the gain going up and down. It forgets about the fact that the lambda is also changing. Gain is 4 pi a over lambda squared. And gain is 0.13 lambda squared. You can see how it all kind of evens out. A well-designed log periodic has equal gain, equal beamwidth across its band, and the area has to change in inverse proportion of the frequency to make it all come out right. Did I say that wrong, Alex? Go ahead.
Not really. No, you didn't. There are not many people being able to visualize what's happening here. I can see it in my mind's eye, but if you want gain, all that you have to do is to enlarge the surface on which the wave is impinging. It doesn't have to be a very thick pipe. It has to be only a large surface. So for the same microvolt captured by an antenna, the antenna can be small or large, depending on the frequency that you're working at or the wavelength that you're filtering. So if you have a 1 meter antenna that works at a 1 meter frequency, then you have say 10 microvolts. But if you have 10 megahertz frequency and you have a 10 meter antenna, might have the same amount of microvolts, 10 microvolts. So it all depends on how much of the, this is called temporal, spatial sampling. If you have more of those in an area like logarithmic antennas, it so happened that I'm working with this stuff now. So I know a little bit about it. If you have more antennas like that in a certain space, but it is within the length or the halfway length, and the maximum is stretched, then you can see the wavelength at time related. Getting into crazy stuff that I don't want to think about. But in a sense,
good night, K2RIW and company. Thank you for another wonderful session.